people just don't like, people want weirder and weirder combinations of random bullshit. So like it's basically like, it's like going to a car dealership, but for a simulated 11-minute stint of time with a woman. You know how you go to like a car dealership and you're sitting there with a car, and you can order a car, right? You order your car, you're like, okay, I want a Ford F-150, I want the extended bed, I want, you know, the clamshell doors, heated seats, this, that. You choose your packages, you choose all your stuff, check all your boxes. Well, if you can think of the anime tropes, you can poke them into YouTube, and you can find hours upon hours upon hours of this shit. And it's all produced in the last month. Like, it's insane. Like, if you like, have a half-listenable audio, and you can, like, semi-sound like an anime archetype, you can get 10,000 subscribers on YouTube, easy. The shit I've seen, and the horrors I've seen, and the sycophancy I've seen is nauseating, and I want to die.
It's those two assholes, those two idiots you saw me talking to at the third rail.
Just, he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That is the third rail, saying white people have interest.
Third rail. The third rail here is good show. Another wonderful show on the TRS network.
It's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
It's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
Watch out for the third rail, baby. That's high voltage.
And the opinion of this reporter, if this nation, or in fact the world, ever needed heroes, that time is now. That time is now.
Like God, cleansing the filth from Chocolate City with holy storms. This is happening. It's episode 212, 212, New York area code of the most huggable Milk Crate Challenge podcast on air since 1973, The Third Rail. We are coming to you almost live in the mobile Third Rail studio, this time from New Orleans, the eye of Hurricane Ida, where Air Jordans are about to go on sale at 100% markdown prices. Hi, how are you? It is Spectre, and I want to thank all the Chans for creating the Milk Crate Challenge and convincing blacks to do this stupid shit, because with dozens, maybe more, blacks now hospitalized or paralyzed, the number of rapes and murders prevented is goddamn astronomical. Joining me is my erstwhile Siamese twin, Borzoi, who agrees that ever since they essentially outlawed calling things gay and retarded, things have gotten more gay and retarded. How you doing, sir?
This episode's going to basically be that a meeting between Naftali Bennett and Biden, where Biden just nodded off during it. And Bennett got everything he wanted, so there you go. That's today's episode.
Yeah, but you said you were tired, so that makes me the Jew. I'm not happy about the situation. Well, I spent the weekend getting a lot of work done, doing a lot of physical labor, and trolling the Police Frequency Telegram channel, which is always fun. And I took some Super Male Vitality for the big brain, and I don't know, man. I think it's actually having an effect on me. I'm a little worried I'm losing my grug. I mean, I'm given to contrafibularities now and anaspeptic, nay, phrasmodic paracombobulation with intrafrastically extramuralizations and sometimes pentagestory compunctuousness. What should I do about this?
Where we're going, we're not going to need rocks.
That was unplanned. I was not expecting that. All right. I guess we can start off with just a couple of quick house cleaning things that are fun. Looks like 18 staffers, freelancers, and contract workers at Vice and Refinery 29 were laid off. Sucks being you. It's actually easier to get a job when you're a doxxed white nationalist, apparently, like me, than it is to be a mainstream working journalist. So, you know, ha, get fucked, journo scum.
Fall is coming. I might need people to rake the leaves in my yard. So, I mean,
there you go.
I'm hiring.
Wouldn't that be great? And then we were talking about this before, but you know, we're both actually word nerds. And I, for some reason, I always just assumed that execrable was related etymologically to the word excrement, and I'm both excited and surprised about the potential there. And speaking of Noah Berlatsky, I actually thought it was when somebody mentioned that this guy got basically busted advocating for pedophilia, I thought it was Noah Smith, who's also an execrable Jewish writer and blue check mark. But Noah Blavatsky is this blue check mark. I don't know if you saw the story.
It's hard. I'm going to be honest, man. It's kind of hard for me to keep my Jewish pedos like straight and organized. You see that video of the guy going through his Rick and Morty Funko Pops? That's me trying to keep straight all the different Jewish pedos I know of.
I mean, it's easier to keep track of the ones that aren't pedos, because there aren't any, apparently, and the way this is laid out. But this guy's a blue check mark. He's an opinion writer. He gets published occasionally in the New York Times, all the usual places that somehow, no matter how mediocre your mind, no matter how poor your writing, you can always find a platform.
His tweets are
protected. I'm sorry, what?
I was going to see what was going on, what was up with him, and his tweets are protected right now.
Well, here's the deal. He the tweet that got him this is not the one that got him in trouble, but going back to 2017, he was even saying stuff like, here's a tweet: pedophiles are essentially a stigmatized group. Certain people get designated as deviants. People hate them. And then the thread continues with him making the case that, well, this is just it's hardwired into some people. It's a sexuality like any other. He works for this group called the Prostasia Foundation.
Prolapsia? What?
Prolapsia, it sounds like. It's Prostasia. Prostasia. And the mind boggles at where this actually came from, this mashup fake marketing word. Because, I mean, you can see prostate in Asia. You can see prostitution in Asia. Things mashing together, going after ladyboys. No, it's a nonprofit. They are a 501c3, protected by the government. Your donations to this group apparently are tax deductible, and on the regular, let me pull up their website, because they pose as, we are trying to help understand this kind of thing. Rather than and therefore help prevent trafficking, child sex abuse, child sexual abuse materials, and that sort of thing.
Their website has Eric Stryker on the front page. I'm not sure how I feel about this.
I saw that. Yeah, that poor guy in the wheelchair. Yeah, it's poor Eric. I don't know how he became. I guess that was back.
I warned him not to sell his photographs as stock images. I warned him.
Yeah. Few things happen, man. Sometimes even a Marxist has to make money, right? But they say that from their about statement, it's protecting children from sexual abuse is a cause that everyone can unite behind. However, the measures we take to combat child sexual abuse are less effective than they should be because they are driven by emotion rather than evidence. In striving to protect children from abuse, we may end up harming them and others. Prostasia Foundation addresses this problem by helping to fund sound scientific research on CSA, child sexual abuse prevention, engaging with diverse stakeholders whose voices are not normally heard, really now, addressing the human rights impacts of child protection laws and policies, communicating the results of our research and engagement to policymakers, platforms, and the public. So they're basically another NGO, a non-Gentile organization,
Prostasia Foundation.
That as a cover. What was that?
Prostasia Foundation is a new child protection organization dedicated to promoting laws and policies that are both effective and constitutional.
We're a child protection organization and a human rights organization. We're actually the first to bring mental health professionals, human rights activists, sex experts, and internet platforms together.
Prostasia takes an evidence-based approach, based on preventing abuse before it happens.
I think we're living in a time when people are frequently willing to think that making policy based on belief is a good idea. I'm not sure that's correct.
We don't shy away from controversy. For example, the idea that maybe we can change the behavior of people with a sexual interest in children, or the fact that the best placed people to keep minors out of sex work or the consensual kink community are sex workers and kinksters.
And so my thing when I encounter minors in kink is, first of all, that's great that you're interested. Please come back when you're 18. Here are some books to read.
Yeah. So, now,
look. We're only halfway into that video. So we already have two things, like changing the sexual desires of pedophiles, which is like they're using big words, and as this is a show that is is pro rock, I understand that people might have like difficulty parsing out some of the things that are being said right here. I am totally sympathize, but yeah, they're talking about how do we help these people, which there you can't. So, well, there are ways you can help them, but I can't talk about that on the air. Or, right. You know, according to Brandenburg v. Ohio, I can't talk about that stuff. But the other one, the last one, Miners and Kink.
Yeah, well, I'll go into some of, like, again, I want to posit that, you know, removing ourselves entirely, not entirely, but just taking a dispassionate step back and saying, you know, moving beyond the natural grug reaction to grab a rock, I actually do understand the concept of if you had, you know, real scientists, real psychiatrists who could go into this and figure out what's causing this in people and, you know, is there a way to prevent it? Now, obviously, we know what needs to be done after someone has offended or somebody has just even admitted that's what they are. But, you know, there's a scientific case to be made for how can we prevent this, you know, from even arising in a person. Great, fine. But they use that as cover. The foundation, their actual goal is to normalize pedophilia. Now, one of the first things I pulled up was one of their directors. Where is he? Dr. James Cantor, who looks a lot like he...
Oh, Cantor? Cantor?
Well, Cantor, but if you look at his picture, possibly he's Sephardic, but he looks an awful lot like a street is a bathroom to him, if you know what I'm saying.
Okay, but you do understand that Cantor is a Hebrew word, right?
No, I didn't know that.
Cantor, like, in terms of like names that are unambiguously Jewish specters, Cantor is like in the top five. It's up there with Cohen and Levi.
Really? I did not know
that. Or Levine. Cantor in, I forget what exactly it is, like a cantor is somebody who has a specific role in a synagogue. Cantor is like on a... Let me put it this way. If someone comes up to you with the last name Cantor, they are unambiguously Jewish, my friend.
Damn. Okay, well, I need to get that software patch because I did not... That was completely clueless on that. I was looking at this guy and I'm thinking maybe he's like Sephardic because he looks very swarthy, but he looks more Indian than anything. But I guess, you know, if the Jew fits, you know. But his bio says, Dr. James Cantor is a clinical psychologist and neuroscientist, internationally recognized for his research on the causes of pedophilia over the past 20 years. His findings demonstrate that having a sexual interest in children is an innate characteristic of neurological origin comparable to sexual orientation. So, there's a great article that, this is why Noah Berlatsky...
Oh, if we're moving on, can I at least finish the video?
Sorry.
Yeah, I want to see where the rest of this goes.
National conversation around child protection excludes these voices. The result is laws like SESTA FOSTA, which censors online speech about sex and puts sex workers in danger.
It was at best hijacked by others to pass a law that really stigmatizes and criminalizes a lot of activity and speech about sex that has absolutely nothing to do with trafficking.
Our society's dominant approach to child protection is sex negative, promoting ideas like abstinence-only sex education and pornography being a public health crisis. This does more harm to children than good.
I think the police department is entirely too lenient with these vicious exhibitions of sex.
So, being concerned about pornography and children seeing pornography is...
Yeah, that's the whole purpose of this foundation is to say, hey, we're concerned about child sexual abuse. However, all these things that you want to do to try to prevent it actually violate the rights of people. So it's basically a protection racket. Now, Noah Berlatsky serves as their director of communications.
Okay,
he's
Let me just finish the video. Like, we got 45 seconds left. Sorry, oh. I really want to see how this ends.
We still have more.
So employing health as a political framework allows socially conservative morality to be imposed against civil liberties by disguising it as a universally recognized project of public good.
Prestasia is committed to promoting and communicating a more balanced and sex-positive message about child sexual abuse prevention.
So this is the first organized entity that I've seen in the almost 30 years since I first began engaging with these ideas that wants to take some of that insight and bring it forward.
We believe that it's possible to protect children while upholding our society's most important values, such as tolerance, diversity, and freedom. We are Prestasia Foundation.
So how does one have a sex-positive perspective on protecting children from being fucking raped?
Good question.
How about it's just we protect children? This is completely neutral to how anybody feels about sex. How about protecting children is your first fucking priority as a society?
How about protecting children even if it violates your fucking rights? How about your rights don't count when it comes to children being abused? How about that? Somebody in the chat, or a lot of people in the chat, are pointing out that, according to them, Cantor is a singer in a synagogue.
Okay, there we go.
And now that you mention it, I actually remember. Do you remember going
you can
back
have your
to...
Right, you can have your rights, but they're also going to meet my lefts.
Now, do you remember, I think it was, I can't remember now if it was the 2008 or the 2010 or the 2012 election, when Eric Cantor.
Yeah, that's why I knew.
Like,
that's why I knew it was a Jewish
line.
Yeah,
he was like defeated by some upstart Tea Party type guy.
Yeah,
and it was like a huge blow because not only was this like a senior Republican in leadership, but also a Jew.
That's how I knew Cantor was like a Jewish name. That's because that's the most famous Cantor I know. And that and there's
if
a
I,
there's
if
the,
I remember
there's
that,
the
yeah.
There was the actor Eddie Cantor.
I don't remember Eddie Cantor. Who's that?
It's just, I don't know. Are you sure you don't remember him? I'm pretty sure he's from your time period.
he was before the talkies, is what you're saying?
He died in 1964, so you must remember that at least.
Oh, yeah. That was a sad day in my life, let me tell you. So Noah Berlatsky, who, as you can guess, is not just a Jew, but he looks like super Jew. He looks like if Ron Jeremy and Howard Stern had a butt baby. This is who he is. He's a writer for, get this, New York Times, NBC Think, The Washington Post, and
NBC Finglethink.
Yeah, NBC Finglethink. But The Atlantic, the magazine now headed one of the most neocon and anti-white magazines, headed by Jeffrey Goldberg, who used to be an actual IDF torturer in prisons in Israel before he came to America to be a journalist. But he also serves as the director of communications for the Prestasia Foundation. And he had to silence his tweets today or protect his tweets because of some bullshit he said, and everybody just jumped on him. He's also the author, by the way, of Wonder Woman. Let me see if I can. Where was that? Wonder Woman, Bondage and Feminism from Rutgers University Press.
Oh, so can you start that over? Because my computer just did a thing, and I don't know if 5 seconds. Just start that over.
The whole thing about him or just what he's doing?
No, just like just whatever the next, like what he was talking about in his tweets. Just start over there.
His blog is called The Hooded Utilitarian. Because he's a comics writer and he writes about comics and pop culture. But he also wrote a book called Wonder Woman, Bondage and Feminism for Rutgers University Press, where, of course, anybody who knows the history of that particular DC character knows that she was invented by a guy who was really into bondage. And it really shows through on a lot of she loses her powers if she's
tied up by a man.
I'm pretty sure he was also
a swinger. He was a psychologist.
Yeah. Just another pervert.
Yeah,
but
basically.
So this is what this Noah Berlatsky, this is how this all came to everybody's attention. Now, there's a website, 4w.pub, where they really go into this about Prostasia and how their real goal is to normalize pedophilia, and it's attempting to gain legitimacy and forward its agenda into the mainstream. And this was published actually today. California-based charity Prostasia is one such deviation from the rule, organizing and having been given the 501c3 tax exemption in 2018. While marketing itself as a children's rights organization, it is a veritable grab bag of causes surrounding sex and sexuality. In their blog entries, child protection as a tag routinely ends up in the same sentences as free speech, kink, and sex positivity. The topics of age play, furries, hentai, and prostitution are spoken about no differently as, and often with no barrier between, child sexuality and child sexual abuse. It is here, in the not-so-hidden depths of Prostasia's pet causes, where it begins to mutate into something far more malicious, deviating very heavily from its veneer of supporting child safeguarding. In fact, protecting children from exposure to sex abuse seems to not just be at the very bottom of Prostasia's to-do list, it's almost antithetical to its entire existence. Prostasia treats the threat pedophiles pose to children as a boogeyman dreamed up by the alt-right, while condemning anti-pedophile sentiment as harmful Nazi-like rhetoric. No lie detected, which requires mass censorship across social media. The organization's efforts have directed themselves to crusades against child pornography bans, letter-writing campaigns to state representatives demanding that child-likeness sex dolls be kept legal. You know what I'm talking about there? Basically sex dolls that are, like, underage. And funding research into fantasy sexual outlets for pedophiles. I mean, basically, a Flammenwerfer would be your first go-to in trying to solve for this equation. These people are horrible. They're the kind of people who have tried to mainstream calling pedophiles minor attracted persons, MAPs, because it's a more socially acceptable way. They recently collaborated with a group that calls itself MAP Support Club. It's an unregistered group which claims to provide peer support for pedophiles and invites minor attracted people age 13 years old and up to participate in online chats about minor attraction. What the fuck do you think goes on in these chats? Seriously.
Most of the viewers or the listeners wouldn't have seen it, but the in that video from the Prostasia people, they're the one that was talking about the being, you know, kink friendly or kink interested, whatever fucking terminology they used. It was just this obese, pink haired woman, and the way that these people go about it is, and this is why they couch these things in terms like sex positive and the like, is how they frame these things are. You're too young for this stuff, but I'm glad you're interested in it. You shouldn't be looking at it, but just remember all this stuff for later when you want to act, when you're old enough for this stuff. They basically play these little semantic word games about this stuff where, you know, it's a tongue-in-cheek wagging of the finger, basically. It betrays what they actually want. I mean, it's obvious what they actually want.
I think it probably goes further. I think it's like, yeah, that's terrible, John screen name. Why don't you DM me and we can talk about this offline?
Oh, you're talking about that? Yeah. I mean, how they even talk about it on the official NGO level is that way. I mean, like when you get down to the actual chat rooms, like no, they're much more overt about that.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Dr. James Cantor, in this article, they mentioned that they reiterate the point that James Cantor says that there's evidence to support that pedophilia is comparable to a sexual orientation. And you know how we always trolled with the LGBT and then adding the P on there?
We're just ahead of the curve.
Yeah, we were ahead of the curve. He actually tweeted out and... Please don't isolate this. Speaking as a gay man, I believe we should include the P. To do otherwise is to betray the principles that give us our rights. How very compelling. Now please face the wall.
I mean, this is like, here's the thing is that you talk to You talk to literally anybody who knows about the history of the quote-unquote gay rights movement in the United States. The stuff has always been there. Allen Ginsberg was a member of NAMBLA. Harry Hay, who is the godfather of the gay rights movement, he was an active supporter of NAMBLA. Here's the funny thing when we talk about the way that they've been kind of they've been. I mean, like, I've always joked that, the whole dichotomy, like, I hate the word Wignat, but, you know, the whole Wignat versus optics cuck dichotomy, like, you can find it in every single group. Well, with homosexuals, you have prep cucks versus hivnats. And you have people like Harry Hay, who was an active supporter of this stuff, has been there since the very start. And there, of course, there were people who wanted to put a more clean face on that, and they did that through shows like Will and Grace. But it's not like that they were biding their time and waiting to be able to spring this. It has always been there from the very start. Anybody who paid attention was aware of this stuff. Everybody who paid attention was trying to ring the alarm bells on it, but of course they were ignored and marginalized.
No, and they sounded the moral panic. If you question whether, like, children should, even high school kids, should be given, lessons about tolerance and homosexuality and sexual instructions and all that, oh, you're just some, what are you, some kind of, like, weirdo Christian? What are you, some kind of immoral? What are you, some kind of Karen? What's wrong with you? You don't have a – maybe there's something wrong with you if you think that just teaching kids about sex is automatically going to be child sexual abuse. I mean, they pull that bullshit. But these people, they will argue, they say, we want to protect children, but you know what? Sex registries, for sex offenders or, school zone bans, that sort of thing, that's really ineffective and it's really unnecessary. Or, I don't know. I struggle sometimes with the words here because, like you said, there's certain things we can't say. In the article, they continue, though, talking about one of their staff members, Guy Hamilton Smith. He was a staff member for the Prostasia Foundation. And in one of its campaigns, they focused on arguing against the necessity of a sex offender registry.
I hate that name so much, Prostasia. It sounds like one of those generic medication commercials. Like, call your doctor if you're suffering from different side effects from taking Prostasia. That's probably intentional.
I think I see in the word either prostate Asia, prostitution Asia. Some there's no way that this is a mistake. This is accidental. But one of the staffer's name was Guy Hamilton Smith, and he's written several articles against the sex offender registry. And he's a lawyer out of the state of Kentucky, and he wrote for their blog as well. And a quick search in the publicly available database of registered sex offenders found that Guy Hamilton Smith was registered after being caught with child sexual exploitation material. So, we see who they truck with. And now, this Noah Berlatsky, he is taken in as the director of communications, and he wrote an article for the New Republic entitled Child Sex Workers' Biggest Threat, the Police. In which he basically said that, all these things about that you see in like TV tropes or movies or whatever of children who are sexually abused and trafficked have been like kidnapped or they're beaten or, all the realities of what happens with child sexual abuse. And he says that's not really the case. A lot of them go into it out of necessity or just desires or just wanting to get away from their religious parents or this or that. Or he limited the treatment of children engaged in survival sex by police officers. He called it survival sex. Survival sex. While fighting corruption within the justice system is a certainly valid issue, the article says, at no point did Berlatsky note the obvious fact that children cannot consent to sexual activity of any kind.
Well, what they do, because they have basically several different layers of how they approach this stuff. Is on the first layer is they just throw a bunch of jargon at you. That's like where the whole idea of sex negative, sex pod is like all this is just jargon. They basically throw all this academic jargon at you so that the grugs don't understand what you're actually doing. Normal people don't understand what you're actually doing. And then the next layer is when they have to make like an actual argument of what they stand for or what they ostensibly stand for. It's that, oh, we can police this behavior better than police, society, culture, normal people can, because we understand it and we don't want to do undue stigmatization. And they'll bring up examples of people who have been quote unquote wrongly killed or lynched or what have you. And then the next layer that they basically just have different layers of how they go down on all the stuff to basically prevent saying what they want to protect pedophiles. That's what all they're really all about.
Yeah. The article continues saying that Prestasia founder Jeremy Malcolm has been known to directly and personally attack those who take any issue with his organization's campaigns. Family lawyer and feminist activist Sarah Fillmore was vocal in sharing her experience with Malcolm, who sent her threatening emails after she discovered that yet another member of his staff, a Jeff White, was also on the sex offender registry for criminal sexual conduct with a child under the age of 13. And the author of this, which I, at this point, because the author did some good work here, I just don't even want to bother digging into her background, even though, yeah, it looks like her name is Anna Slatz. But that's really neither here nor there, because the work is good. She says that she was also subject to disturbing erratic behavior from Malcolm after calling his organization into question in 2019. He insisted that she was a racist neo-Nazi sympathizer, and he republished photos of her as a young child with abusive captions. So this is where we are. Our government recognizes, as a foundation, as a charitable foundation, as a nonprofit, a legal nonprofit, where you can donate your money and it's tax-free, and they have certain exemptions and protections, that basically normalizes and promotes pedophilia under the guise of we're trying to protect children. And that's where we are in this world. And there's not a lot I can do with it. There's not a lot I can say about it, because a normal, healthy society would let me express the solution to this, the anger at this, but that's not the society we live in.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like, look, we are well, listen, Spectre, you and I are just too tired old men, just basically talking.
Too tired dads.
Yeah, okay, I wasn't sure. Yeah, two tired dads just talking on a podcast to each other, trying to at least make the decline a little bit more informative and edutaining for people, because there's nothing you can do. I mean, like, if you have local power, like, now don't get me wrong, if you have an ability to make a stink at a, you know, at a board meeting or a PTA meeting or what have you, I mean, we have to take up space. Don't get me wrong with this. We have to take up space, but we say this stuff because you got to tell people what's going on. I deal with this all the time with family members who don't want to believe how bad it actually is, and this is how bad it actually is. We've been warning people this is coming. We're gonna have to keep warning people that this is coming, and even after it's become the when they've assumed the role that's being prepared for them of being the rulers of this land, the more explicit rulers of this land, we're gonna have to keep talking about it. That's what we're gonna have to do. But
isn't this whole thing though just evidence that the argument that anything is a slippery slope has never actually been true, or that the slippery slope is always true, and that the idea that it's a fallacy is not? Because maybe these people weren't involved, but a normal, healthy society would not tolerate people saying these adults, even prostitutes or porn actors or whatever, they're sex workers.
Well, the issue.
Because then once you legitimize sex worker, then you can bring it down to, well, why don't we just, you know, legitimize child sex workers? I mean, what is a drag kid who actually has dollar bills thrown at him on a stage by homosexual adults? What is he but a child sexual worker?
The issue with the slippery slope is that is that they basically apply it as in the pure realm of logic. Yeah, you cannot make an argument that we can't do X because then they're going to next do Y. Like, it's basically taking everything in that extremely logical way. But in terms of patterns and in terms of actual fucking politics, yes, the slippery slope is real. Like, it's just like, if you want to be autistic about logic and debates, then yes, the slippery slope is a fallacy. But the slippery slope is just frankly reality, because that's how politics works. You start with one goal and then you move to the next goal. That's just how it goes. It's how it be.
Well, to use the big cliche, it's a frog boiling water.
Yeah.
It's how you boil a frog in water. You start real low and you slowly build up the heat until it's too late.
Well, speaking of pedophilia in America, I actually have some prep right here as well. Is that did you know that a teacher in California is in trouble for teaching the kids the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag?
Are you talking about that one teacher or just in general?
I think you know what I'm doing.
Oh, I see what you're doing.
Yeah, I think you know what bit I'm doing.
it took me a second, sorry. It is late and we're body sleep at this point.
Well, also, I kind of called an audible on this. California teacher investigated for instructing students to pledge allegiance to gay pride flag. Like I said.
And I watched that video. I get the idea that this woman may not even be gay herself, but this is the problem of ungoverned single women.
Oh, I guarantee you this is probably, like, at most, she's a girl who calls herself bisexual but has a boyfriend or a couple of boyfriends.
She kissed a couple of girls at a college party to get attention, and so she calls herself bisexual.
Yeah.
Because she's not completely unattractive or a fat ass, so, you know, she definitely is not a lesbian. Because lesbians are fake.
I'm going to play this video.
Newport Mesa Unified School District says what that teacher says in that video does not align with the district's values. They are now investigating this. Meanwhile,
Are you sure? Are you sure about that? It doesn't align with your values. Are you absolutely sure about that? Because I doubt that very heavily. I feel like you guys are just mad. You're not sorry. You're sorry you got caught.
While a lot of parents are very concerned and shocked by what they heard that teacher say.
So my class decided to stand but not say the words. Totally fine. Except for the fact that my room does not have a flag. It used to be there, but I took it down during COVID because it made me uncomfortable.
The school district says that's Kristen Pitson, who identifies herself as an 11th grade teacher at Back Bay High School here in Costa Mesa. She starts that TikTok video by saying that during the Pledge of Allegiance, she gives students the option to stand and say the words. She goes on to share that her class does not have an American flag and that she took it down during the pandemic because it made her uncomfortable. In this video, Pitson says a student asked why there was no flag recently. She says she tells the student she would try to find it.
All right, now I'm thinking, like, with the name Pitson and the flag making her uncomfortable, there might be some ethnic origins here that need to be investigated.
There's some loxism going on here.
But then admits she's lying. Parents in the area say they are shocked by what the teacher says next.
In the meantime, I tell this kid, we do have a flag in the class that you can pledge your allegiance to. And he, like, looks around and he goes, oh, that one?
Again, this video is now under investigation by the Newport Mesa Unified School District. A spokesperson says, I assure you that we take matters like this seriously and are taking action to address it. Showing respect to our nation's flag is a value that we instill in our students and an expectation of our employees.
X.
No, I don't know, man. I feel like what they're just kind of saying is... we show respect to our nation's flag, and as far as they're concerned, that flag is the nation's flag. How is it not the nation's flag?
Maybe it's an issue of it that they're conservative, so they prefer the traditional gay flag, the one that doesn't have the tray, any stripes on it. And this is, you know, this is just too...
The 13 to 50 flag.
they don't like the tranny stripe flag.
What is the chief export of the United States? It's not any product we make. It's homosexuality. It's sodomy.
Sodomy and usury.
Yeah. Sodomy, usury, and usury, sodomy, and abortion.
Yeah.
USA, baby. I don't know. Let's assume she's probably a Jew. But if she weren't, in her case, I would think this is what the problem of ungoverned women. All it would take is a healthy society and a normal man. And she would be having them pledge allegiance to the swastika. I mean, she would go along with whatever the current zeitgeist is that would get her brownie points, because that's the way most women are, single women. They just go along with whatever is, you know, whatever the power structure is.
Yeah.
It's also why TikTok has to be destroyed. It's cancer. Social media in general is cancer. I know we've all had to use it, and we used it to birth a lot of our connections and our movement in a lot of ways, but the idea of giving everyone a voice and not a good idea. Not a good idea. And, you know, like, if you go to the retarded echo chamber that is Twitter, I mean, you can see that there's absolutely no reason for Twitter to exist, because the people on it are horrible. And the people on it should not exist either in Minecraft. But that's just the way it looks. I don't know, man. It's too late to get as upset and rage-filled as I want to get over this. So should we move on or what?
Yeah, it's fine. It happened to pop up for me on I found it on Bang. Bang actually good for something for once. So mostly what I get out of Bang is finding out that Pastor Anderson's like giving out religious exemptions to for anyone who needs it for vaccines, and that Ed Asner is dead. That's basically what I learned from Bang recently.
Wait a minute, Ed Asner is dead?
Yeah.
I didn't know he was sick or alive, to be honest. Jesus. How'd that old Jew stay alive? Oh, what am I saying? The blood of innocence and foreskins.
Amazon forgot to deliver his foreskins. That's why he had to pass, unfortunately.
Foreskins as a subscription service.
Foreskin loot crate.
Perfect. That's the show title.
That's gonna be hard. That's gonna be hard to top.
Yep, Sven is gonna be very jealous that never came up for them. So the other article I had anything deep on is this comes from Reuters. It's not some, you know, again, there's a whole lot of fly-by-night and clickbait places where you can get anything published. Reuters, theoretically, is a legacy media institution. Goes back, I think, over 100 years. Used to have a decent reputation as just an international wire service. But Reuters Investigates did a special 3,000-word hagiography. That's a very positive and almost deification of a subject that you're writing about.
That's a big word for you.
I might sometimes play a little bit less or a little more grug than I am. I know words. I know things. Smart. I know things. I'm not dumb like everybody says.
Somebody's been reading the Scrabble approved word dictionary.
It's a word a day calendar, motherfucker. I literally only have to read one word a day, and that's it. Now, dictionaries, like, come on, how gay is that? It's called a dictionary. I mean, come on.
How are words and women the same? When you see them, it ruins your day.
I'm gonna get that tattooed. They did this profile, 3,000 words on this Antifa lady, and I was not going to read it at first because I thought this is just going to be more bullshit. But then I thought, think about the cartoon caricature that they try to paint of white nationalists. You know, they lump us in with the Trump supporters and the QAnon and the 3%ers and all these other losers that we have nothing, you know, to do with anymore. You know, certainly not with Trump anymore, and we never had anything to do with QAnon or the 3%ers or anything like that. But, of course, we all get lumped in there because, you know, neo-Nazis, and all they want to do is gas Jews and blah, blah, blah. And I did enjoy, by the way, speaking of Antifa, watching over the weekend, once again, Antifa getting their shit pushed in, as they do every time when they don't have state power behind them. But I read this article, and let me give you it mainly focuses on Nicole Armbruster, age 37.
Nicole Armbuster?
Armbruster. With a BR armbruster. But if you look at her picture, she looks like a very angry dyke and extremely possibly a nose person. I mean, she's got the nose. She is, as Larry would say, almost definitely a wizard.
More like Nicole Nosebuster.
But so they do this, you know, the way they write these is not just to, you know, give you the facts, but they got to paint this big picture. And she's poised for a run in the spring. She's donned her Iron Man hat from her triathlon days, her black running shorts and her gray Brooks running shoes. She reached over to train her dog, Azuri, a muscular Catahoula hound with pale eyes so it wouldn't chase a squirrel. And
oh my
so
God.
Right there, you're just like, she's just like everybody else. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Do you know what she looks like? She looks like the Virgin from the Virgin versus the Chad meme.
She does. Actually, you're right. I didn't think about that.
Nicole Buckbuster.
But so, again, just imagine even a neutral article about profiling one of our guys, much less one that is just this fucking obsequious. And I, again, the words escape me. I only know a few. But she's 5'5". She's under 130 pounds. But she's a militant activist in the far-left Antifa movement. She has clashed on the streets with the right-wing Proud Boys extremist group and with the alt-right movement and with police. She has an arrest record that dates to 2003 for charges of unlawful assembly, failure to disperse, violating the Rioting Act, and assaulting far-right leaders and a police officer. Do you think that, and this is like just arm wave, I mean, the hand wave, just, yeah, she's got these, but, you know, she's fighting the good fight. I mean, imagine them, you know, doing the same to, you know, in a profile of one of our guys. You can't. And I know I'm doing the whole hypocrisy thing, but still. She says, we are prepared to put our bodies on the line in the event of police or fascist or racist violence. And it's really like a duty to humanity to do that. These people really are that fucking just delusional and so far up their own ass. The writer says militant Antifa activists rarely speak publicly. Some have been hostile with journalists, shoving them, shining laser pointers at cameras, and using umbrellas to thwart videography. And if we had a history, if people on our side had a history of that kind of thing, our movement really doesn't have that history. But if we did, that would immediately be like they would list those things and say, and this is how they're a threat to democracy and a threat to free speech. But no, this is considered like these are things for her to be proud of. Or at least it's understandable that she would be hostile to journalists. And they even go into Antifa, short for anti-fascist, achieved a mythic and mysterious stature under Trump, blah, blah, blah. They say their aim is to confront those they see as racist and fascist, with the activists employing anything from social media campaigns to public protests to street violence against their adversaries. So, again, they're just documenting and stating as fact that these people plan and execute violence and initiate violence against anybody that they deem an enemy. And yet, anybody on the right, whether it's Trump supporters or Threepers or QAnon or Proud Boys or us, immediately are just labeled as violent conspirators, a conspiracy of violence against all that is good. But this is like, hey, she's part of this group, and they're planning violence, but look who it's against. Isn't that great? She'd been a Girl Scout and blah blah blah, but and she grew up.
Her last name is Based. I didn't realize that Armbrust is German for crossbow.
Yeah, I was about to get to her. Her background. She says she once lived a more conventional life in Washington, D.C., even as she engaged as an Antifa activist. She worked for 6 years as a day camp coordinator for the Girl Scouts of America, National Regional Capital Region. She had been a scout herself as a girl and can still recite the God and Country Creed. Camp, she says, is such an important part of kids' growth. Over the years, she has worked as a children's camp director, nonprofit fundraiser, and swim coach. And if literally any of our guys that was being profiled by any news organization said, hey, you know, in addition to the things that I believe, the dissident right ideas and my political activism, I work with youths as a camp counselor or a teacher or whatever. What is the immediate response? He's indoctrinating the children. We've got to get him fired. But no, this is considered like, oh, look how good a person she is. She works with children. She speaks the language
Well, hey. Prostasia works with children.
Oh, that's a good point. And she, again, she keeps on recapitulating that she is violent and her people are violent and they initiate violence. I know I sound like a fucking libertarian when I say initiate violence, but it doesn't matter who starts a fight. You know, I'm sorry, that it does matter. She says anti-fascism is more than just punching Nazis in the face. Nonetheless, she believes violence can serve a purpose. You can embarrass Nazis, which makes it harder for them to recruit. You can beat them up and they're embarrassed. As I said, really the only time Antifa ever wins is when the police are there to arrest anybody who fights back against Antifa. As soon as the police aren't there, or as soon as the police just back off, Antifa gets their shit pushed in good and hard. Of course, she was born into a well-off family in suburban New York. She went to St. Lawrence University, a liberal arts institution established in the 1800s in rural New York State, and she engaged in as an activist while a global studies major. Global studies is now a major? What the fuck? Jesus, they college.
How bad have colleges fallen that people are studying globes as an actual major? Like, I got a globe. I look at it sometimes. It's just
so basically, you're pretty much a master in global studies at this point, then, is what you're saying. No, I used to say that there's a thing that you can take your kids to called Wolf Creek Lodge, and it's like an indoor water park and adventure thing. It's basically a hotel, but built around parents with younger kids, and they get to run around loose to the hotel and cause all kinds of havoc. And there's games where they go on a quest, and you can buy a wand, and then you can buy bling for the wand because it's like a dragon adventure game that goes, you know, kind of interactive. In addition to the pool and then slides and all that, and it's just like a machine made for vacuuming money.
Bling for a wand. I just imagine Larry Ridgway as like some kind of Harry Potter parody. Larry Potter.
You're a grand wizard, Larry. But I used to think that was like the peak of being able to vacuum money out of your wallet, but out of the wallet of a parent. But now apparently universities, even more so than I even suspected, they are just like, they have perfected the art of stealing money. Global studies, Jesus.
Chat brings up a good point. It's not, the problem isn't that they're studying globes at college. The problem is that they're actually teaching kids that, or teaching adults, really, that the world is shaped like a globe. I thought we were past that.
I know. I mean, who believes in that conspiracy? That's like Q stuff, round Earth. I mean, come on. Jesus Christ. Yeah, I'm Australian, mate. I got my harness and everything. Jesus Christ. Armbruster said that the seeds of her dissent were planted early. I bet. When she learned about World War II and Hitler's Germany as a child, she developed a revulsion for Nazis, fascists, and state wrongdoing. My family is from Germany. And you learn all the horrible things. All the horrible things. It's actually
speaking of Germany and all the horrible things, you know that picture of like that, you know, fags basically, like the point to, that's the guy who's got the arms crossed over and he's refusing to do the Roman salute. And you know, the story behind that guy actually is that I guess he's like married to a Jew or something, but we need to start telling people the reason why he's crossing his arms is because he was just a turbo spurg who thought the National Socialists were just too soft.
I always assumed that he'd been like saluting so hard earlier that he was just tired at that point. He was giving it a rest. Like, oh, no. I want to throw another Roman, but I can't. He was
a gay retard, but we're from now on, just, much like how we're going with the meme that Evola was bombed by niggers, we are now going with that guy was just a turbo spurg.
That's probably true. But it's actually true what she says. She says that she learned from an early child that Germany did all the horrible things, and she learned her revulsion for Nazis and fascists. It's because, as they pointed out on Friday's Tedious, or they've reiterated for a millionth time, and rightly so, that they indoctrinate you with this shit, this concentration camp, Holocaust nonsense, fan fiction. They indoctrinate you when you're too young to have any critical thinking skills, and all of a sudden you're exposed to all this gore porn, And of course, it creates a revulsion in you, so you never bother questioning it. And, you know, believing all that stuff about the National Socialist and that era is it's a child's fantasy. It's what a child would believe. That kind of world. It makes no sense, but it presents you with this: here's the ultimate villain, here's the ultimate good, and yada yada yada. Everybody lived happily ever after in gay America. So she's not entirely lying when she's not lying when she says that she learned early on to hate Nazis.
Yeah,
and,
America's a Marvel movie.
Yeah. She talks about, you know, how they have, you know, their tactics include deplatforming, but she says that while some Antifa use social media to deplatform foes by exposing far-right members online, her friend and her deplatform with our hands and feet, maybe a piece of wood or something. You know, that means punching or kicking, just in case you weren't sure.
Okay.
Again, in what world, for starters, you know, yeah, she's 5'5", 130 pounds. I'm not really that particularly worried.
She could be taken out by a t-shirt cannon.
Yeah. But in what world do people who continuously boast about wanting to do and doing violence and having done violence, are they considered, well, that's a morally neutral stance because, you know, look at who their enemies are. Okay. Clearly they're the good guys, and so if they're using this tactic, then fine.
This is actually just more plausible, but, you know, just for the sake of the meme, I'm going to file this under "that's bullshit, but I believe it" category, even though it's probably true. Name redacted says she has a Jewish boyfriend, so there you go.
Hmm. Well, I believe it. She talks about what she did on Trump's inauguration day, January 20th, 2017. She joined hundreds of Antifa members dressed in black bloc. For all of that, she stood at ready with a bicycle as Bikers for Trump motorcycles headed down an alley. "I got this bicycle if they attack. I'll just throw it at them," she said. Before he could act, police moved in from two locations and they just pepper sprayed me. Really good spray. They're detailing the violence that they engage in, and yet nothing. This lady says all but two charges against her have been dropped. Meanwhile, you have a group like RAM who literally do nothing violent, and at one point, you know, a couple of their members had to defend themselves, and they are taken to be some sort of violent conspiracy group, violent conspiracy activist group. It just makes no sense unless you understand, one, the Jewish question, and two, that America as a society or as a political entity hates white people and wants to destroy them. But they continue on. And I basically, as I like to do when I read too much, I learned absolutely nothing about the real Antifa that I didn't already know. And it turns out they actually are more in the cartoon caricature that I always imagined they were than I could have hoped for.
Oh, well, here you go, by the way, on the name Arm Brewster. This one actually is funny to me because it's from Metro Detroit. There's a let's see, his name's Keith Arm Brewster from, let's see here, where is he from? Livonia, Michigan. Because I was just looking into this. He says, it's basically him talking about synagogue architecture, but so in my social circles, I am kind of like the rabbi to all my non-Jewish friends, Arm Brewster said. When someone has a question about something Jewish, they always come to me. Or no, actually, maybe he's just the architect. I don't know. Whatever. Sorry, I thought I found proof, but that could actually just be a case of him just being custodial staff.
No, it's
just a shabbos guy, I guess.
Yeah, probably. Well, that's the problem with Antifa. When they're not those that are not either Jewish pedophiles, but I repeat myself. The rest are just these fucking clueless butt boys, always mentally ill. You look at the pictures of like that Andy Ngo posts of like the mass arrest of Antifa in Portland and Seattle, and it just looks like this just dysgenic, colorful haired, crazy people with crazy eyes, just. You know, like I said, those that aren't Jewish pedophiles are absolutely gaslit white people that are really – I don't like to ever say that any white person is beyond saving, but the reality is.
Well, no. Really like, here's the thing, and this is why, like, you know, Yaki is interesting with the way he kind of viewed race, and I know there are people, genuine people, not disingenuous people, but genuine people who take some issue with the way that Yaki viewed race. Long story short, people who aren't familiar with what I'm talking about here, Yaki had an issue, because he was a Neo-Spenglerian, had an issue with what he viewed as a 19th century materialism, with the way that they tried to reduce race down to a purely genetic thing. For him, race was a little bit more of a complicated thing, kind of like a Mussolini race is a feeling type thing, coupled with kind of an environmental thing and a heroic spiritual thing. Like, race was a number of things. Basically, it was like a you know it when you see it type thing. And he's got this whole thing in Imperium where he talks about the men of no race, were men who mm-hmm. have been completely devoid of race, regardless of what their genetic reality is. It's basically what Yaki was kind of describing before anyone had terminology for it, was the small soul bug man. Is really when you, like, the one who keeps thy heart small. That's kind of what Yaki, in his very esoteric philosophical way, was kind of getting at. And I take that and I just run with that, because that's why we have I've separated out people who, you know, genetically should be white, but racially they're just different. TV race, media sapiens, whichever terminology you want to go with that, gay race. Like I don't consider them us. They have racially diverged from us. So, I mean, if their divergence is that severe, then I don't feel a need to wonder about, like, oh, can we save this person or accept them into the white family? They went off and did some weird, you know, some weird like media sapien shit that I can't relate to. I'm a completely different species from them.
Yeah, I want to point out something very specifically. I know I'm pointing out the hypocrisy. I know that only goes so far, but just the way that these people are treated by the so-called mainstream press versus us. But it's also about how they're treated by the Kritarchy, by the judiciary, because they mention here her arrest record in Washington, D.C., Arizona, Virginia, Minnesota, and Florida dates back to 2003. All those charges I mentioned earlier, unlawful assembly, failure to disperse, violating the Rioting Act, and assaulting a police officer. And more specifically about the police officer, let me skip down to where it is. In 2012, she was charged with assaulting a police officer after a World Bank and IMF protest. The charge was dismissed. Meanwhile, my friend Greg Conte, one of the officers in the National Justice Party, very, very good friend, he was at a protest, there was a protest at a place where he was legally permitted to be.
It was the Michigan thing.
Yeah, the Michigan thing. And in a moment of scuffle, he like reared back and like towards somebody he couldn't even see who was behind him and bumped the guy. And it was a police officer in full body armor. And the two of them actually laughed about it, because he immediately was like, oh, sorry, my bad. And the cop laughed about it. And he wasn't even charged until like 2 days later, I think. Maybe it was longer than that. But at least 2 days after that, they finally got around to deciding, hey, this guy's a piece of shit. He's a white nationalist. Let's charge him for what? He tapped a police officer by accident.
Because I remember when that happened, the impetus for and what gave them the ability to like apply the charges, I think, later, it was that he was what's the word I'm looking for? He was restrained, like basically he was pulled aside for a moment. It wasn't just like it wasn't an in the moment thing, but he was kind of the detained. That's the word I was looking for. He was detained for a moment and then let go. And then
and they laughed about it. Yeah. He said that, you know, the cop actually he and the cop kind of joked about it. It was no big deal. I mean, you've seen what the cops let people get away with, and this was literally an accident. And not only have they fucked around with him by giving him these charges, but if you followed him on Telegram, you know that he's had two different hearings where they didn't – and he's a pro se defendant, meaning he's defending himself. They did not inform him of either the venue of a hearing, whether it was online or in person, the first time. And so he drove all the way to Michigan and then found out that day that, the hearing was to be held online. and he actually had to serve notice on the court clerk to ensure that it was recorded that he was there and ready to, you know, go to the hearing, that he had never been informed. And then more recently, he had another hearing come up where they didn't mail out the notice to him until like 4 days, four business days before the actual hearing, that he had to be there. So he's several states away. He's defending himself. His resources are what they are. And they're not even informing him. He didn't get the letter until like almost a week after the hearing that he was supposed to be there for the hearing. That's how screwed up it is. And that's how the judiciary has two different standards. One is, oh, this person is at very least Jewish adjacent, if not Jewish herself, but she's Antifa, she's anti-Nazi. So therefore, she gets her charges dropped. This guy, who's as innocent as fuck, let's just fuck with him for the next 2 years. And by the way, whatever happened to the concept of a speedy trial? Fuck these people.
The only thing that was incorrect about Franz Kafka's book, The Trial, is that it was about a Jewish person.
Yep. Damn right. I seem to have already run out of prep. Wow, we've actually burned through the two topics I really wanted to hit tonight pretty quickly.
Well, I mean, I got two things. Don't worry. Like we're going to hit at least 90 minutes. Don't worry about that. Okay. I got you covered. It's, I guess we got some Hurricane Ida updates. You know, like some. I got some breaking collapse updates.
Let's see this. Tell me the detail.
Well, I mean, like this is like ongoing news. So, I mean, basically, New Orleans has basically been canceled permanently by the storm, it seems, or at least not for a while, because like we're looking at Hurricane Katrina levels here of what's going on. Somebody in the Graph Boys Pine chat. Actually, what are we calling right now? Brothers Against Corn, Guided by Allah. That's the current name of our chat. Confirmed the main transmission tower that feeds New Orleans has collapsed into the Mississippi River.
Basically, no way, the whole thing.
All of New Orleans has no power. It's reportedly from everything. I mean, I used to live down there. I still got some people down there, and yeah, they're telling me it's bad. I mean, like a lot, they've all evacuated because they're smart. But I got people that are telling me, yeah, it's bad down there right now. And the big thing about all that is that it's not just New Orleans that's being taken out; it's those surrounding areas that's actually affecting a lot of. It was some kind of specific crop, grain, I think. Grain and oil is going to be affected by this. So we're probably going to see. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, it's going to affect gas prices and food prices most likely on some level, but again, like, you know how the system is, like they do things and that don't really make a lot of sense in order to, you know, prevent the whole thing from collapsing in under itself. So I don't know how they're going to react to this. They'll probably try to make sure that there's no disruptions, but I mean, you're seeing infrastructure problems.
Oh, let me add to that. One of the major refineries that apparently handles upwards of 18% of the refining of U.S. domestic oil is in the New Orleans area, and it has been all but destroyed. So not only is that thing going to be out of commission for a long time, but you also have all the oil going everywhere, hopefully killing, like salting earth, essentially.
Yeah, here we go. Somebody posted, Mississippi Weather Network, breaking news, Mississippi Weather Network sources have confirmed that the Shell Mars Olympus deepwater oil platform has broken loose. The platform is now free within the Gulf of Mexico. According to the Shell website, this oil platform was located approximately 130 miles south of the city of New Orleans. This remains a breaking situation. MWN will continue to relay the latest information on anything Hurricane Ida as it becomes available. #tracking the tropics.
Yeah. And on top of that, one of the major deep water oil rigs off the coast of Louisiana is floating free now. Not a good thing for an oil rig to be floating free.
No.
Do you remember the whole Deepwater Horizon thing from what, 2009, 2010, something like that?
Oh, yeah, somewhere around that time period.
Yeah, so all that oil's pumping into the Gulf, and that's going to have a major impact, because I remember that had a major killer impact on tourism in the Gulf region, because that, you know, in the Gulf Coast area, that area really relies on the tourism dollars during the summer and spring and fall seasons because it's always hot there. But and it's beautiful. It's the best part of Florida, as far as I'm. It's the only good part of Florida, the Redneck Riviera. But it was made, you know, it not only affected the fish, the shrimp, the shrimping, the all that, and then also the tourism. It just, you know, entire swaths of beaches were closed. It wasn't just that people weren't going; it's that they closed them down. So coming off of you know, whatever base DeSantis has done to keep Florida open, despite COVID, looks like parts of Florida are going to be closed down.
So that deep water thing that got redacted. Mm-hmm. I did the thing I keep telling people stop doing is that don't go off of screenshots. You need to get the actual links. I made a mistake myself as well. But that, in my defense, they actually did report that, but they later redacted it.
No, okay. Well, still, it's going to have a major impact, all that oil from the refinery.
Yeah. There's going to be issues. It's just going to be the what is the extent of said issues and can they mitigate that? Like the thing about I feel like I need to explain this oftentimes because of I'm associated as I become associated as being the collapse guy. It's not an all or nothing thing. It's basically the health of a society is how does it respond to the problems that occur. And if over time its response is getting worse and worse and worse, that's how you know you're living through a collapse to the point where eventually you get to the point there is no response. Mm-hmm. So it's diminishing expectations is what it is.
That's a good point, too.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people also will say, as they did during Hurricane Katrina, why did they build a city below sea level? And, you know, this is all just, it was going to happen, blah, blah,
because,
blah. Well,
because it's at the mouth of the river, you fucking idiot. It's like you have to, you build cities where ports are.
Yeah. But beyond that, you have the Netherlands, where a good portion, I don't know the percentage wise, but like at least 20% of the country was reclaimed from the North Sea. They just build out these dikes and then drain the water, and all of a sudden you have farmland.
Screw you, ocean.
Not that easy, obviously. But they don't seem to have that same problem with, you know, the collapse of their infrastructure that supports the levees and that sort of thing. Now, granted, they don't have the hurricanes like that area does, but still.
That's a terrifying. I'm telling you, man. Like I happened to live there when there wasn't. We got lucky that year there was no hurricanes. Living like looking up at those levees is a terrifying feeling.
They were built by American contractors for the lowest, you know, by government contractors for the lowest bid, and maintained by quota hires from the state and the city, that should really scare the shit out of you. Like if there were, North Sea has some really, really bad storms, and if there were the equivalent of a hurricane force, you know, in the Netherlands, I would still feel pretty safe there. Both in terms of the levees and the dikes holding, as well as, you know, being able to, you know, the society being able to evacuate people from a dangered area. New Orleans, it's like, fuck it. I mean, do you remember one of my favorite things after Katrina, you had Governor Mary Landrieu, the female governor at the time.
Yeah, from the Landrieu family.
Yeah, and they were having press conferences in the days following, and they showed her a picture of a school district area where they had like about 100 school buses parked, and they were all underwater, or at least, you know, up to their roofs and underwater. And they said, well, there are all these buses here. Why didn't you use those to evacuate the people of New Orleans? And she looked at them with a straight face and said, well, those buses are underwater. It's like, wait a minute. They weren't before the fucking hurricane came, you dumb bitch. But nobody could say anything because you don't want to criticize a woman for saying something stupid in public. Well, they don't want to. We want to. But, I mean, that's just the going with the concept of collapse, just the incompetence that you have at the top, these figureheads who hold office.
Yeah, it's we'll see what the reaction is. It's just that's the thing. Like, there's not going to be let me put it this way, I wouldn't expect severe disruptions. But that's not how these things go. It's death by a thousand paper cuts until one day you realize, like, I'm not really living in a functioning society anymore. In fact, I don't think the authorities are around anymore. You know, like, for example, you take a look at a city like Detroit, you go there, there's cops there, there's politicians there, there's business there, there's ostensibly civilization there, but if you have an issue, don't expect it to get solved. Yep. You're on your own. And that's how these things go. Like, there, it's that, and that's why, like, you know, barbarians, cartels, whatever you want to call them, whatever the time period you're in, that's why they're able to take over. Because when things get so bad where you live that the barbarian that's on your doorstep is offering protection, and you know that who's supposed to be protecting you isn't going to be coming. It's like, all right, well. Not particularly fans of them, but they're here and they promised to solve the problem for me. Guess I'm paying them protection money.
I think that's maybe why so many people on our side are, whether seriously or just ironically, cheering on the Taliban. Obviously, even if we cheer them on for what they've accomplished for their own people, that doesn't mean we want to be Taliban or be Muslim or anything like that. We're enjoying their what they've done to defeat global homo in their own lands. And, you know, 20 years ago, to any of us who had even a single patriotic bone in our body, the idea of lionizing these people or cheering them on was anathema. It was like, it was disgusting. Like, these are the barbarians. These are horrible people, blah, blah, blah. But now it's like, I totally understand where they're coming from. I don't agree with them on everything, but I totally understand where they're coming from.
Here's the thing. Like, you got to abandon ideology. Like, you got to look at realities here. Like, and I don't care if this gets clipped. I don't care if people try to say things about me because of this. But let me put it this way. If you lived in an area and a cartel member basically strongly implied that you need to pay him protection money, but you know that he's going to wipe out, say, pedophiles, for instance. If you tell me that you're not going to be paying them protection money, I'm a little bit skeptical of that.
Well, and maybe in this way that the Jews are kind of like victims of their own makings. The way they push the concept of like the anti-hero in popular culture. You know, the guy who, we don't agree with his methods, and he's kind of a shady dude, but he gets the job done, and he gets the bad guys and that sort of thing. You know, that's pretty well implanted and imprinted on the minds of the American public, and particularly the TV race.
Yeah,
and so we look at the Taliban. It's like, hey, they're rough around the edges. Maybe we don't want them, you know, in our neighborhood. But you know what? They get the job done. I'm glad they're out there. Thanks, Batman.
I don't want to live under any of that stuff, but.
Me neither. No.
I'm not offered choices I want to have. So I mean, what do you want me to do? Like, I am not going to try to create some kind of ideological justification for any of this stuff and try to find, like, wow, they're just like me, one struggle type stuff. I'm just going to take a look at the bare tribal facts of the situation and just say, like, look, I'm not offered choices that I like. I'm going to look at this from a mercenary perspective. It's like, okay, that's what I choose. I'm not going to give you some kind of, I don't know, some kind of third position as a justification for it. Like, and try to find some obscure esoteric text that explains, like, oh no, actually it's okay for me to support them. Like, it's just they're doing what they're doing, and I don't like what my enemies are doing. That's the situation.
Yeah, it's like we know a lot of the stuff about the mafia is both de-Judaized as well as, fictionalized and mythologized. But at least the mythology of, like, the mafia, with, like, whether you're talking about The Godfather or just the way it is in popular culture, you know, the idea that, you know, you're living in Little Italy and, you know, you got the corrupt police, you got the blacks, you got the drug dealers and all that. And then you have the mafia that comes in and they're like, well, we're going to keep that shit off our streets. You're like, yeah, I don't agree with what these people are doing, but, you know, my kid can go to school without being offered heroin or being beaten by black people, so I'm for it.
Oh, do you want to talk about that stuff for a little bit? Like, this is because I didn't realize when you asked me to talk about the Operation Gladio stuff last week what you were actually asking me to talk about. So first, you were a little like you didn't realize that the Jim Morrison stuff was from a completely different book that was from Weird Scenes from Inside the Canyon by Dave McGowan. For people who don't know this, by the way, Jim Morrison from The Doors, his dad was the admiral that was in charge when the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened. Kind of weird, isn't it? Kind of strange. Kind of a bizarre thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I've only like heard the edges of a lot of this, but the talk about how the anti-war movement and the anti-war left was corrupted in the 60s through the sex, drugs, and rock and roll stuff. And how the hippies were, you know, led down that path and became an ineffective, opponent of it hadn't been labeled that, but it was basically the neocon war machine. And so I thought that when you were talking about Gladio, that maybe that was part and parcel also of, you know, moving into the 60s with the way they used some of these pop culture figures to derail the anti-war left. So I'd only like touched on the outsides, and you know more about it. So I'd love to hear more.
Oh, that's the whole thing that Jim Morrison's dad, like it's never talked about. Jim Morrison's dad was the admiral in charge when the Gulf of Tonkin incident happened.
There was more. I mean, like whether it was you're talking about Allen Ginsberg, all the people who had influence that moved them away from.
Dave McGowan and I don't think I really didn't like enjoy the book all that much because like I don't like Dave McGowan's writing and he doesn't really like. There's like three or four really good books in that book alone that if you were to take those all because a lot of his stuff is basically like oh look at this connection isn't that interesting which okay yeah admittedly it's interesting but you gotta like. Synthesize this here together, Dave. Basically, what it boils down to, if you're familiar with the Laurel Canyon stuff, all that counterculture stuff, all that 60s culture stuff, all the music especially, like, all those kids were military brats. Like, a lot of the most famous musicians from the 1960s, the ones that are associated with counterculture stuff, a lot of them had parents or who were in military intelligence or actually were kind of possibly doing military stuff themselves. Steven Stills, for instance, it's been
Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. Jimi Hendrix is brought up in the book as well. Like a lot of these people have military connections, much like serial killers often have military connections.
Well, doesn't this prove out the idea that perhaps Jim Morrison did his bit and then quote unquote died and disappeared and you know then became Rush Limbaugh?
It does make you wonder, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But the most interesting thing to me from this is from the book Operation Gladio. The most interesting thing to me was the connection with the mafia, and this stuff was so infuriating to me. People who follow my post or Telegram kind of probably already saw it, but I know your relationship with words, so I don't know how much of it you read, but. Let me see if I can find. Yeah, here we go. So Lucky Luciano, who, if you're familiar with mob culture, that name you'll know that name. Lucky Luciano is one of the most famous mafiosos. He was part of the syndicate. I think it was also.
He's involved in the city of Las Vegas as well.
Yeah, he partnered heavily with Meyer Lansky. Actually, Lucky Luciano was in contrast to a lot of the mafiosos was. Extremely philo-Semitic. I mean, like, look, crime. The mafia's they've kind of self-mythologized. At the end of the day, they're criminals, and they're doing everybody want to be a gangster till it's time to do gangster shit. Types, you know, that's the reality of the situation.
Everybody wants to be a white nationalist until it's time to do white nationalist shit or contribute to white nationalist causes.
But Lucky Luciano went above and beyond on.
Oh yeah,
that stuff.
He was a fucking glowy. He was a glowy. Yeah.
Well, so I'm gonna give people the context for them. So here's the thing about Lucky Luciano, why he stands out in contrast to a lot of the other Italian mafiosos. By the way, I'm sure a lot of our people know this, but organized crime is actually more Jewish than it is Italian, or at least it was historically.
Let me correct you there. Judaism is organized crime.
True. Heroin represented a minute part of the commission's business, the commission being the kind of the conglomeration of the different organized crime bosses. Before World War II, America had less than 20,000 heroin addicts and less than 1,000 kilos were produced annually throughout the world. Use of the drug in America remained largely confined to Asian immigrants and black musicians, and most made men, the term for fully initiated members of the mafia, shunned drug peddling as an immoral and unmanly activity. My tradition mafioso Joey Bananas wrote in his memoirs, "Outlaws narcotics. Men of honor don't deal in narcotics." Lucky was the exception to this code of honor. He established the heroin trade of Turkish and Chinese opium merchants, saving a considerable amount of the good stuff for the women who worked as brothels. The drugs served to strengthen their dependence on upon his largesse and goodwill. Indeed, the combination of organized prostitution and drug addiction became one of Lucky's trademarks. By 1936, he controlled 200 New York City brothels, employing 1,200 prostitutes. These establishments provided him with an estimated annual income of $10 million. So already, like, you like the whole Epstein thing, Epstein was not like an anomaly. That was just a pattern of how
it's a trope. It's a trope, right?
It's a trope, exactly.
Jewish tropes, I mean, they keep repeating throughout history.
You know, Lucky Luciano, who is best friends forever with Meyer Lansky, you know, just completely coincidentally was the mafioso who broke the general taboo on the narcotics trade.
Of course.
But here's where things get really galling. So, for people who aren't aware of this stuff, while Bill Donovan was the guy behind the OSS, which became the CIA, so at Wild Bill Donovan's request, Commander Hoffenden again appeared at Lucky's cell for request for help. At this time, this is in World War II, Lucky Luciano was in prison. Luciano complied.
He's in prison for pandering, for murder, for prostitution, or pimping, for like so many ridiculous.
For being a spiritual Jew.
One or two weak cases. Sorry, go ahead.
He's in prison for being a spiritual Jew.
Yeah. But I just want to say, he wasn't like in prison on just one or two, like, well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't, or, oh, this isn't. So, I mean, he was like, they had him on a slew of stuff to the point where he had to appeal it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Luciano complied by drafting a communique that was then airdropped near Don Carlo's farmhouse. 2 days later, American tanks rolled into Villalba. After driving 55 miles from the beachhead of General Patton's 7th Army in Palermo. This is by the way, if people don't know these days, this is the Allied invasion of Sicily during World War II. Mm-hmm. Don Carlo and his men climbed into the tanks and spent the next 6 days guiding the division through western Sicily and organizing support among the local populace for the advancing U.S. troops. Thanks to the success of Operation Husky, the codename for the Allied invasion of Sicily, Don Carlo was appointed mayor of Villalba. As soon as he assumed public office, Don Carlo murdered the local police chief, whom he found too inquisitive. Other mafiosi, at the insistence of the OSS, assumed positions of political power. Giuseppe Genco Russo, Don Carlo's second in command, became mayor of Musumeli, while other members of the Vizzini Agostino crime family became chief governing officials of other towns and villages in western Sicily. The appointments were understandable. Donovan wanted anti-fascists in charge, and the mafiosi were most certainly anti-fascists, since many had spent the war years in Mussolini's jails. So, there you go. Like, criminals are anti-fascists.
Yeah, well, to put a bigger context on this, he was in prison. He was going to be there probably for the rest of his life. And in 1942, the Office of Naval Intelligence actually went to him and said that they were concerned about German and Italian agents coming into the United States through the New York waterfront. So they would agree to commute his sentence if he would ensure that, one, that his buddies would make sure that that didn't happen, and that, two, that there were no strikes during the war, because they didn't want any wartime strikes, because despite what the mythologized history is, the war was very unpopular, especially in 1942. People had no problem with the idea of going to war with Japan, but they certainly didn't give a fuck about going to war with Germany. It was not a popular thing both in the United States or in Britain. And so the idea that the dock workers might strike and slow things down and fuck over the war effort was actually a real possibility. It wasn't like they could just go, oh, aren't you patriotic Americans? Aren't you going to help us fight the Nazis? No. People, it's like, what, you're going to ration shit to us? You're going to tell us we have to, you know, be drafted and go to this bullshit war? No, there was a very real possibility. So once again, even as early as then, the United States showed that let's go into a conflict and pick the biggest piece of shit, the worst possible human beings, and let's ally with them.
Yeah.
That's who our buddy should be.
Very impressed, by the way. So, you did your homework. I'm very impressed.
Well, and then during the war, like you said, he not only did all this on the docks, but he also provided the Army and the Army intelligence with the mafioso contacts to begin with, even before setting them up after they had arrived. So they had intelligence on the ground from the mafioso who in Sicily who were not actually jailed by Mussolini. And Mussolini jailed those people because these people are scum and they were detrimental to society. And somehow, it turns out, fascists actually care about the good of society.
Yeah. Well, here's where it gets galling right here. By the beginning of the Second World War, the Mafia was restricted to a few isolated and scattered groups and could have been completely wiped out if the social problems of the island had been dealt with. The Allied occupation and the subsequent slow restoration of democracy reinstated the Mafia with its full powers, put it once more on the way to becoming a political force, and returned to the Onorata Societa, the weapons with which fascism had snatched from it. So the Allied invasion of Sicily restored the Mafia to its the organized crime to its full power on the island of Sicily, which, because with the chaos of that, it forced people to rely on them again when if the social problems had been dealt with. They were on the verge of being totally wiped out. It was they were on the cusp of fixing Sicily, basically. The return of the men, the return of the men of respect became a nightmare for ordinary Sicilians. Shifting from rural to urban crime, the mafia bosses led by Don Cala graduated from the stiletto to the Beretta and the Tommy gun. From 1944 to 1960, the bosses commissioned an average of 3 murders a week. Scarcely a shred of their fabled knightly code of honor remained by the end of Don Cala's reign of terror. The ascendancy of the mafia also became apparent with the appointment of Vito Genovese, Luciano's right-hand man, as chief translator for the U.S. Army headquarters in Naples. New York's former Lieutenant Governor Charles Poletti, whom Lucky described as one of our good friends, was also appointed as military governor in Italy. Thanks to Poletti, Genovese's men controlled the major Italian ports and thereby most of the black market in American and Sicilian goods such as flour, oil, sugar, beans, salt, and cigarettes. Even Genovese's lowest Picciotto, the youngest and most inexperienced man, made a bundle. How did I accumulate my fortune? I did the black market during and after the war, Luciano Leggio, a henchman for Genovese, later explained to a jury in Palermo. Now here's where it gets extremely galling. This was the part that made me so mad when I read this. Thanks to the success of the invasion, Lucky Luciano, which, remember, the man who basically made the heroin trade explode in the United States, Lucky Luciano became the subject of massive media hype, which culminated in radio broadcaster Walter Winchell proclaiming the mobster should receive the Congressional Medal of Honor. Walter Winchell not only was a Jew, he was the Jew who basically destroyed Charles Lindbergh's reputation.
Super Jew!
By the way, I have no proof of this, and I'm researching it because I want to find proof of this. The FBI certainly thought this. I totally believe that the Purple Gang is behind the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. And if you don't know who the Purple Gang are, they were the Jewish gangsters of Detroit, and they were notoriously so brutal that even Al Capone wanted nothing to do with them.
Yeah, the whole, you know, code of honor and all that stuff is a lot of self-serving mythology from the mafia, even the Italian mafioso. But yeah, when Al Capone doesn't want to deal with you, you are really a fucking piece of shit. Oh, by the way, just so you know, and just in case you had any doubts about the demonic nature of all of this. The collaboration between the U.S. Navy and the Mafia was called Operation Underworld.
All right, I got one more story, and I know Jazz Hands. I'm pretty sure Jazz Hands doesn't listen to our show, but if you're listening, Jazz Hands, I already know you know the story. But for just for the sake of the bit, I mean, not to go ahead to the casino, my guy, and cash some more clout coins right now. This is from the Times of Israel podcast. How Jewish was Alexander Hamilton?
No bullshit. That's not real. You made that up.
It's
no way.
Yep.
Times of Israel is now admitting that Alexander Hamilton is Jewish, or at least Jewish.
Or they're talking to a guy they're talking to a guy who's making the argument.
Oh dear God! From Jazz Hands' lips to the chosen people's ears.
So, U.S. founding father had Jewish roots and a Jewish day school upbringing in the Caribbean, experiences that influenced him in colonial America, says author Andrew Porwancher. Welcome to time. Porwancher has spent the better part of a decade researching the Jewish world of Alexander Hamilton. Prior to Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical hit on Broadway, we discussed Porwancher's research and his engrossing thesis about American Jewry, including what it means to be a Jew in Hamilton's time. Part of what I hope to do in this book is develop a theory of Jewish identity that goes beyond binary Jew or non-Jew, said Porwancher. Oh, I'm way ahead of you. I have a very robust racial theory, my guy. What I hope to do is to ask the question, is Hamilton Jewish in any sense of the term for any stretch of his life? Porwancher discovered Hamilton's Jewish roots by chance as part of another research project he was engaged in at the time. Yeah, I bet it was listening to FTN hoping to find material to dox people with. He's listening to our FTN deep dive on Alexander. I was like, oh, I've never heard of this before. This is very interesting.
Well, I think they hate it, so it must be great that he was so Jewish.
I have literally like now Jazz Hands stuck and they put out his clout on this. He said he basically said. Hamilton was Jewish, and it's on you to prove to me that he wasn't. I hedged a bit more because I just, there's a very interesting stuff, but it's one of those things where I'm cautious to say something like that unless I know for certain. But
well,
I gotta,
your stake at the Clout Casino is not quite maybe as big as his, or no. At least, yeah, so... You don't want to risk those chips. As many chips there as he's willing to risk on that one.
Jazz Hands is the guy that says, put it all on black, guy.
No, he never bets on black. Absolutely. I know that about him.
His mother had converted to Judaism to marry her first husband, and while she was already separated from him by the time Alexander Hamilton was born, she raised Hamilton in her adopted faith, enrolled him in a Jewish school where he learned Torah in Hebrew. Now, that was the thing that was heavily debated, and that's what I was cautious about because the name of her first husband, Lavine, it's, you know, presumably it's pronounced Levine. It's just there's a lot of debate about him specifically. Some people say it's a Danish name. I mean, but then the fact that it's Levine, that's kind of a funny coincidence. And then he goes to the Jewish school. Which is the argument that Jazz Hands made and all that for the most part. It's like, look, there's just too many weird coincidences of all this for it to be coincidental. Porwancher uncovers a long string of myths about Hamilton in his book in order to think critically about how that history may have informed Hamilton's experience as an adult in colonial America. Hamilton has a closer relationship to the Jewish community than any other American founder, said Porwancher. The Jewish world of Alexander Hamilton includes historic material about Jewish life in the nascent nation and an examination of attitudes towards Jews in the American colonies and after independence was declared from Britain. Porwancher also speaks about the timing of his book with Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway hit Hamilton, which was in previews at the time he began his research a decade ago. He briefly met the... I don't care about any of that stuff. Anyways, yeah. So, I mean...
I feel like once you understand the JQ, it's like the cheat code to the world. Everything becomes clear, and then even the predictions you make are almost certainly going to come true because you actually understand how this whole thing works. And to me, that's just further proof that we're not wrong on all this.
Yeah.
And by the way, you mentioned Danish, and so I've been kind of fixating on that because I'm a little hungry now. And I do want to say, and you'll appreciate this now as a dad, you can appreciate dad jokes. I really was in Denmark, and I spent like at least 3 hours asking people where I could get a Danish. They didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. Well, apparently, yeah. They don't call them Danishes in Denmark.
Well, they don't call them French fries. They don't call them French fries in France.
I didn't go to France. Why would I? I did. It was just a bad dad joke. It's getting late.
But I'm autistic, my man.
I know. What do you think? We got anything else? How did we make it to an hour 45? That's pretty good.
You got me on Operation Gladio. That's how we got to an hour 45.
That was some good stuff, though.
Oh, no. All right. The wife was listening to the episode. She says, I like the show. And I just told her, it's the right balance of silly and informative, this episode.
I think so. Well, do you want to hit anything else before we get out of here?
I don't really have anything else.
Okay. Well, before you plug, I'll go ahead and do the other plugs.
I don't really have anything to plug, so don't worry about that.
Oh, okay. Well, catch Larry Ridgway almost weekly on Hate House, one of the best shows over there on TRS Network. Our good friend Nikkei is on The Young Ho Whites, also on TRS. We have the National Institute for Gamer Review from DK. I actually, and this is a little bit of a personal plug, I did a little 30-minute call-in show with Lewis on Skyrim. You can catch it over there. Don't listen to it if you're not into Skyrim or gamer, because it's not. We talked about some stuff and how it bled over to the real world, but it's only for gamers.
Spectre definitely puts the gay in gamer.
You're not wrong. I think that's everybody I can plug for with shows right now. I want to thank how many listeners turned out today. More than 200 on a late Sunday night, so I really appreciate
especially when we didn't really announce it either. That's the thing. It's like we really didn't know what was going on today. And we try to put out an episode every week, and it's difficult sometimes.
And I know you have nothing but contempt for the audience, but
outright hate them.
You outright hate them. That's true. And you even like limit the chat to only subscribers, so. That many people turn out to join us in the chat.
We are unironically doing OnlyFans here.
Go to national-justice.com. It's really surprising when a day goes by without Eric Stryker making a major scoop. Go to distant-mag distant-mag.com. It's from the guys who do FTN, and they turn out some of the best deep think articles. NationalJusticeParty.com. They tell you everything you need to think, and they tell you everywhere you need to send all of your money. I'm kidding about that last part. AntelopeHillPublishing.com. These people are the salt of the earth, and they are putting together an ecosystem of fiction and nonfiction literature.
Damn, called it only subs.
Only subs. Only based. And then join us at the TRS Radio Network behind the paywall for premium content. And it's therightstuff.biz/paywall. That's it for this week. Remember, peas and carrots, peanut butter and chocolate, nationalism and socialism. Two great tastes that taste great together. Mr. Producer, hail victory. See ya, Kyle. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.